This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor, welcoming Professor H.J. McInerney, International Relations, to comment on six capitals and six points of view in the Ukraine conflict, which is turning into geopolitical reorganizing the furniture for the 21st century. Some call them blocks, some call them areas of interest, regions of interest, interest alone. However, right now we have a contest between what appears to be the Russian Federation, its ally China, the People's Republic of China, and what appears to be NATO. Not so, says the Kremlin most recently. I go to the Financial Times headline in these last hours. Vladimir Putin's new doctrine calls U.S. main source of threat to Russian security. The first paragraph. The Kremlin has adopted a new foreign policy doctrine which identifies the U.S. as the, quote, main source of threats, end quote, to Russian security, describing Russia as a, quote, distinctive state civilization with a, quote, unique historical mission. Showing a picture of Vladimir Putin looking not too focused behind his desk. Professor, a very good evening to you. Moscow's point of view at this point wants to identify the U.S. as the driver of the disruption in Eurasia. How do you measure Moscow now after all these very strange decisions that have been made about mobilization, about assaulting Bakhmut, about throwing missiles against the infrastructure, and now they claim the U.S. did it? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Well, what you talked about a rearrangement of everything, and what's becoming clearer, really, with every passing week is, as we say almost every week, that war termination is going to be the challenge we face, and that we haven't talked about it scarcely at all, and that that you have to get that right. Otherwise, what you're doing is simply setting, planting the seeds for another war. So, if we go to Moscow, I think I haven't been there recently. I haven't been there in the last couple of years. I haven't been sort of talking to people on the Nevsky Prospect or something and finding out what's going on. But I think there is a sense that we are approaching some kind of an end to this conflict. But how exactly it's going to end and when and what the peace that comes out of it, hopefully, is going to look like, no one knows. But Russia, really, Putin and Russia are really exhausted. Russia is going to be bankrupt next year, no money next year, according to the projections of Russian budgets. Furthermore, it's quite clear that it's reasonably clear that there's no realistic way for Russia to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. We've heard about a big offensive. You remember explaining it on the air with the columns of sort of panzers in the northmost part of Ukraine and other columns in the southmost part, closing in on a kind of immense encirclement and annihilation, and with the poor Ukrainians caught in the cauldron and so forth. And that, we haven't seen anything like that at all. And I think that although they're talking about a huge mobilization of both men and women, I just don't think that that's really what's going to happen in Russia. As you said, I think Putin is he's really at a loss. And he is at a loss. There's nothing he can do now. People are blaming him for destroying Russia. And that might sound, Russians are blaming him for destroying Russia. And that might sound far-fetched. But when you think about it, and you think of what a complicated process over several hundred years went into putting together the Russian Empire, and then the Soviet Union, and then the Russian Federation, are they going to be able to do anything? What Putin is doing now is he's trying to get weapons from North Korea and in exchange for food. And he's also buying some stuff from Iran. But this is not an answer. He'd hoped that China would come in, but apparently some American diplomat explain to the Chinese exactly what would happen to them if they started supplying weapons to Putin. And they were China was sufficiently frightened that China began positioning herself as a mediator in the midst of this thing, which is most implausible. But what we've also learned is that even among the Russian elite, Putin elicits a kind of disgust. There is a leaked conversation between two oligarchs, Yosif Prigozhin, who's no relation to Yevgeny Prigozhin, who runs the Wagner mercenaries, and an Azerbaijani billionaire. They're both billionaires, Farhad Admirov. And they are just, Russian has a very rich, vulgar vocabulary. And the way they talk about Putin is obscene, and it's incredibly negative. The conversation was leaked, I think, by Akhmedov. And what it shows is really a disgust with this whole situation. And of course, if you are an oligarch, you're watching your assets either shrink or be frozen or gone. Yet that means they're not going to like Putin, but Putin needs his oligarchs. He can't run things without some people supporting him and paying and all the rest. So the word from Moscow is that Putin's exit is now under discussion. And what people expect is either a military coup or a dictatorship or a civil war. And as I look at it, I have to say I think that civil war is the most likely outcome. Think of the Bolshevik coup d'etat in 1917. It wasn't until the civil war that ensued didn't end until June of 1923. So it was over 5 years, the Russian civil war, which is incredibly bloody and destructive. And Russia was never, it was Stalin who put Russia together again with lots of American money. And once World War II ended, Russia had a kind of a, they kind of peaked with Sputnik, and then they started a long decline. And what we're now hearing from Russia is that domestic struggle's already going on. Putin's army is fighting with the Wagner mercenaries. In Russia itself, there are independent military formations that sort of appear and disappear. There's a great deal of railroad sabotage, comparable to what it's thought the Chinese are doing in our country. But Russia really depends on railroads, and they've had some. Apparently, the supply lines to Ukraine are constantly being cut. So, who would be the most logical person to take over? Well, they're very, very, very intelligent. Minister of Defense Sergei Shoigu, who's from Tuva, which is part of what we used to call Tana Tuva, which is a Mongol statelet. It's on the Mongolian frontier with Russia, just a little bit south of Novosibirsk and southwest of Irkutsk. And what I would ask is Shoigu, who's probably the smartest, and he's a very, very tough guy. He can't win the war, but that's not what it's about in Russia right now. Does he have enough power to somehow, just with his own strong arms, to pull together 6.6 million square miles? And I think that's unlikely. And when the troops retreat from Ukraine, is Putin going to be greeting them? I don't think so. I think Putin will have made an exit. Is there going to be a passion in Russia to avenge this loss? No. I think there's going to be a shift to an entirely domestic focus. So as in World War I, Russia will withdraw from a foreign war to which they were tremendously committed and slide into a civil war. And this is going to lead to Eurasian disorder, And remember how many players there are. Russia borders on 14 countries, ranging in size from Azerbaijan and Estonia, small size, to Kazakhstan, Belarus, and China, and not far from India. So all around Russia, there are going to be countries wanting to have a say in how Eurasia is reconstructed.
Professor, can you entertain the idea that Putin could be out of power and be alive? Is that possible?
Well, I think the Russians have a sort of the mafia kind of conviction that it's better to have the person dead. Or the way the Chinese, I mean, they've had their the bat lady from Wuhan is thought to be in the United States, and one of the reasons that we're starting to talk about the long derided lab leak theory is that she's said to be here. And I used to worry about her because I thought she knows so much that the Russians are just going to shoot her as a precaution. But she did such a good job of towing the line and apologizing and lying and everything that they finally let, as what I hear is that they let her with her family go to Montpellier, which is beautiful, right on the the south of France, with her family, just as tourists. And then they somehow were exfiltrated and they're somewhere in America, according to the rumors. And that's one of the reasons that we're getting more focused on the lab leak theory, because we have somebody who was in the lab working with us. I don't know whether that's true or not. That's just rumored. But certainly we're at a stage now where the real issue is war termination, right. And it is a multiplayer game.
All right,
it's
going to
be damn difficult.
Let's go to Keep then about war termination. We've speculated about termination from the Russian side. This is Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, commenting on Six Capitals, Six Points of View. Keef next. Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations. Keef's point of view, and I contribute this, Professor, in conversation with my colleague Anatole Levin, who's returned from more than several weeks in Ukraine, 9 days of which he spent in a hospital in Zaporizhia under enemy fire. He was damaged in he fell down and hurt himself, his ribs. He's repaired now. But he reports that Zaporizhia is pummeled almost every night, the Russians firing missiles in, a city of 400,000 on the Dnieper River, the gateway to Crimea. And yet no one was running to shelters, the pictures of the blitz and go down to the cellar. He said he slept through many of the bombardments that would come too early in the morning. And his and his roommates did as well. One man had injured himself falling off the back of a personnel carrier. Another man had had a car accident, injured ribs that punch into their lungs, and so they have to mend carefully. And they would sleep through these bombardments, saying, "John, listen. It is Verdun, but only near Bakhmut, along the Donbass frontier. The rest of the country is very large, and it's not a well-to-do country, so people are close to the land, and they carry on their lives now that it's springtime. This is not a war that you can imagine like science fiction. It's all the terrain is torn up, and people are dying in droves in cellars. It's not Stalingrad for the rest of the country." Keefe's point of view, however, he emphasized, is that this war will end when we recapture Donbass and Crimea. That's what he tells me.
Well, that makes sense. And his observation about how the how Ukraine is returning to a kind of normality, journalists say that they kind of miss the old days when there was lots of bangs going off, and there were roadblocks, all, and they had to go through checkpoints and all the rest. Now you can just tootle around, apparently, and there are almost no checkpoints, and the electricity's on in the cities and all the rest. And I think Kyiv is both militarily and diplomatically strong, although with the caveats that they are supported, they depend on that rock of stability, namely American politics. But I think they are poised to win in Crimea. And you get some sense of how unimaginative we are, or how unrealistic we are about how this is going to end, because I think it is going to end in Crimea. And I think the Ukrainians are systematically opening the way, and they're already, there's a lot of sabotage in Crimea and all the rest. But rather than asking ourselves what's going to follow, Washington is terribly worried that if we supply the Army tactical missile, ATACMS system, which would make it much, much easier for them to get Crimea without taking enormous casualties, we think that this is going to be that the real danger is escalation, because we would be crossing a so-called Russian red line, and that's completely, I think that's quite unrealistic. And the Ukrainians already have a partial hammerlock on Crimea, because the water supply is cut off, and the bridge is not within range of anything they have right now, but the bridge across the Dnieper, as they have destroyed, and there are a lot of Russians leaving Crimea. And what's going to happen, I think, where this war is going to end, is that the Russians are going to withdraw after some kind of a defeat, and whether Mr. Putin is going to meet them as they retreat into Russia, I think it's highly doubtful. And then Kyiv is going to become a new sort of hub of strategy in and challenges and conflict, potentially conflict, in Central Europe. It will shift. We used to worry about what happens if the Red Army comes into the Fulda Gap in Germany, but that's now not not really what it's all about. Kyiv is likely to become the nucleus of a new emerging European power. And remember that Ukraine is the second largest country in Europe after Russia. So if Ukraine is really independent, sort of operating at the level of efficiency of Poland, which is about one quarter the size of Ukraine, and then you have other countries all the way up to Sweden that will be part of this, there'll be a new strategic center. And it's interesting to me how on the four corners there is a kind of a harmony. If you take Kyiv as the center, then it's 800 miles east of Berlin and a bit over 500 miles west of Moscow. So it's not quite equidistant, but it's pretty surprising how close it is. And then it's about not quite 800 miles south of Stockholm, and likewise north of Ankara. So you can see a new constellation appearing there that is, in certain ways, reminds one of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, the dissolution of which was never followed by a hard delineation of nation states in that part of the world. So we'll be reopening a problem, which is, where do you draw the lines?
Professor, I contribute one other piece of information from Anatole. In conversations with Ukrainians, he had a guide, and he was there officially because he's a journalist from Quincy Institute, and he has the Russian, and I imagine the Ukrainian as well. He did say that it's the Ukrainian position that they're going to recapture Crimea before the war ends. And that there, from his point of view, from his information, there is the risk that Putin would then go to a tactical nuclear weapon in the defense of Crimea or to destroy the Ukrainian army in Crimea before he left power. And that this opinion is in Kyiv as well as on the front line in Zaporizhia, and that it's consistent with other opinions he's heard in his travels. And he believes that Crimea is the most dangerous moment that we have right now for nuclear weapons. Crimea, not the Polish frontier, Crimea itself. I add that twist to his report.
I think it makes a lot of sense, but we cannot. Crimea has to go back. If we quail at worries about Putin, then that's not the way war is. War is a matter of using force to submit, make your enemy do your will, and it involves, as Clausewitz says, the conclusion of the schlock.
I just wanted to get that in before we turn to...
I think it's very important, yes.
The Brussels point of view. Professor H.J. McIner, international relations, commenting on six capitals. We're headed to Brussels, the twin capital of NATO and the EU. The EU watching very carefully the European Central Bank, interest rates, Christine Lagarde making it very clear that the recession is upon them. She's going to fight it by raising interest rates to keep away the fear of inflation for those on fixed incomes. And NATO as well, running out of ammo when we come back. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Professor H.J. McIner. Six capitals, six points of view. We're on to Brussels, the twin capital of NATO and the European Union. The European Union is caught up in concerns about the recovery from the pandemic, the very high inflation, which appears to be moderating mildly. But the struggle will continue. NATO, on the other hand, is looking for ammo everywhere. Professor, NATO is a question mark. Is it capable of taking the burden of this war on its shoulders? And also, after the war, is it capable of maintaining its defenses against whatever remains of the Russian Federation?
Well, of course, NATO is capable of doing all of those things. The question is whether they, at what point they will be convinced that the United States isn't going to take up all those burdens and let them go back to whatever it is that they do. I think that the end of the war is going to lead to a sort of an agonizing reappraisal, to coin a phrase, for NATO countries. Because if you think of Brussels is not, it may be quite centrally located if you're interested in Britain, France, and Germany in a potential conflict. But if the center of gravity or the pivot point or whatever of Eurasia is moving, as I described, well to the east of Berlin and even closer to Moscow than it is to Berlin, then NATO is utterly marginalized. That is to say, the core states of NATO, the Western states of NATO, the ones that understand that their neck is on the block, are already really part of this new hard atom or this new hard alliance of the Bucharest 9 and the other states there that are simply not going to allow Russia to win. So NATO could unite, pool resources, have a unified command. Even Macron, can you imagine de Gaulle arguing this? Macron says it's time to have a European army. And this is only 70 years after the end of World War II, and the president of France has figured out that it would make sense to have one big, strong Russian army, or rather NATO army, and not to have a French army, which attempts to be make France a superpower like the Soviet Union or the United States, which is what de Gaulle could never get over the fact that France was no longer what she'd been under Louis XIV or whatever. But if NATO does not unite and become influential, then the danger she faces is that she's going to be sucked into large-scale chaos, because not far to her east, I suspect there is going to be fighting. I really don't see Russia making a transition from the, as it turns out, disastrous rule of Mr. Putin to whatever is going to come next. I it's hard for me to take seriously the idea that it's going to be peaceful. I think it's going to be conflictual. Yet on the other hand, I find it hard to make myself believe what my own logic tells me is the case. The other thing that NATO has to deal with is that there are new players coming in, because I said Russia has 14 neighbors and China has got nine countries that are right border with her, and then she has, I mean, you're all of a sudden, you're unrolling the, you're enlarging the sort of the tennis court of global politics from a relatively cozy, I mean, you could get from London to Moscow by train in about 2.5 days to something that goes all the way to the Pacific, and it is going to touch on China, Turkey, Iran, India. These are all going to be new players. So there's going to have to be a tremendous amount of vision and careful and very competent statesmanship.
The concern also about Brussels is about Brussels and NATO is the ammo. That is not something you could snap fingers and find immediately. The equipment is flowing to Ukraine. The ammo, though, is running low. The Russians keep up a much heavier fire rate than the Ukrainians, suggesting that what comes after the war is a consideration of what? Reestablishing the industrial base? Just quickly, what are your thoughts about
Well, they're going to have to really, we're going to have to reestablish the military industrial complex, because it's what we see now is that what we have was basically, it's been cut a lot since 1991, but we were preparing to fight the Soviet Union, which is a formidable power. It turns out that all the stuff we created for that isn't even enough to keep Ukraine supplied. Now, this is the way countries are, that we face bigger challenges at sea than we ever have before. Our fleet is below 300, and under this administration, it's going to shrink by two ships this year. And that's not how you prepare. That's not how you have to have a strong army and strong military to keep peace. That's the most important thing. And then if you get in the war, you've got to have enough stuff so that you can push the war back and sort of tie it down before it expands.
I agree with you, Professor, but we're going to a capital that is in doubt. That is, we're going to D.C. It is not at all clear that D.C. is looking at the geopolitical danger of Crimea, nor the geopolitical threat of the People's Republic of China's PLA Navy, which is now larger than the U.S. Navy. When we come back, we'll be at Washington, D.C., asking Point of View with Professor H.J. McIner, International Relations, the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. The Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Professor H.J. McIner, International Relations, commenting on six capitals, six points of view. And it is discouraging, Professor, to report to you that towards the end of the reporting week in which I cover the world, it was necessary to speak of the indictment of a former president of the United States. It was discouraging at the same time. It reveals the possibility that Washington, D.C., the Congress, the White House, the judiciary, the media, are all focused on one parochial story and have very little a patience for or attention to what we've been talking about, Crimea and the dangers in East Asia with the People's Republic of China, where, again, the provocations are obvious in threatening Taiwan. What is Washington's point of view? Can you tell through the noise about the indictment?
Well, you assume that there is something beyond the noise. I'm not a Washington insider by any means. I haven't set foot there for at least a year. But I am very concerned because this, if you think about who is it that's going to do the big thinking about what the new order in Eurasia looks like? Well, if we go back to World War One and World War Two, Korea, Vietnam. Now, of course, we fouled up, and China. We fouled up recently. We did have a great Secretary of State some time ago, namely John Quincy Adams, and we haven't seen his like since. And I think it's fair to say that, particularly in this administration, there are people who are there. People, I hear people say that these are staffers. In other words, they're people who are very good at doing things that they're told to do, but they don't have the kind of imagination, say, that, you know, to wheel a few people out. I mean, someone like George Kennan. Kennan, I could give you all the caveats about, but he was able to think about Russia in a way that was, to a large extent, true to Russia, although Roosevelt never understood what Kennan was trying to tell him about Russia being a dictatorship. He wasn't good on military, but he was able to pull together with his colleagues, a very outstanding group at policy planning in the post-war period. He was able to pull together a practicable, politically convincing approach to this astonishing reversal of the Soviet Union, because, of course, when Roosevelt died in April 1945, Roosevelt believed that the UN was going to be the solution to all the world's problems. But by 5 years later, at the most, that's the longest time, we had the Berlin airlift, and it was quite clear that Stalin was not going to be discussing everything in the UN Security Council and working hand in glove with France and UK and the United States and, of course, China, which was then Taiwan. So we had to. This is one of the reasons we have no good studies of the Roosevelt administration, is that it ended, and then all of a sudden the world was turned upside down by the unexpected reality of the Cold War. And I don't think, frankly, that there have been people in Washington at any time since that period of policy planning who have the vision and the imagination to deal with something on the scale of a realignment of Eurasia. I mean, we haven't, not since the St. Petersburg agreements of the St. Petersburg, what is it, St. Petersburg Convention in 1907 that sort of resolved the so-called great game between Russia and Britain / India. We haven't, it's been a long time since this area has been realigned. The Soviet Union was definitive for a long time, and then it began to break up, and I think it's going to continue to disintegrate. This is just going to be a huge challenge. I think it's beyond the capacity of our current government, and this could be said looking back, not, you know, in a bipartisan way. Nobody is able to think in this way, and nobody has enough sense to be able to criticize. So, as you're suggesting, we're going to really levitate from reality and get lost in sort of courthouse, county courthouse politics. And this game of revenge and gotcha and all the rest, and the tremendous bitterness that, say, Trump feels, that the Clintons feel, and this new and very disturbing trend towards the embrace of violence to support issues that should be decided in a reasonable democratic way. We're not in good shape. And so therefore, I think that it's far past time for Washington to start, get out a map of Eurasia and start penciling in different versions of what it's going to be. But I don't see any sign that that's happening. I think they still imagine it somehow that Putin is going to sit down with the president of Ukraine and, you know, maybe Mr. Biden or whatever, and everybody will be kind of calm and ruminative, thinking, well, how can we restore peace? And then rational decisions will be made. Well, that's certainly the most unrealistic. I think it's a very unrealistic thing to imagine, although, of course, it would be very good if we could do that. But I just don't think that's on the cards.
Professor H.J. Machender, international relations, commenting on the disappointing, apparent disappointing. No, it's disappointing. And the apparent disinterest. I'm never sure whether it's disinterest or...
It's not disinterest.
It's a lack of interest.
Yeah, it's lack of focus on. I mean, just disinterest means that you're neutral.
Yes.
You're detached.
Yes, thank you. Lack of interest in the geopolitics of Ukraine or East Asia. We're turning to East
Asia. Or the world, yeah. We're talking about the world, the world island, as I put it so brilliantly back about 100 years ago. Eurasia, that's where everything is.
Well, we're headed there. Beijing. Professor H.J. Machender, International Relations, the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Professor H.J. Machender, International Relations. Two capitals in the world island. The first, Beijing. Xi Jinping making threats routinely now. Is it 2024, 2025, 2027? He's going to recapture, or regain, or bring back into the fold, or invade and destroy Taiwan. So we go to Beijing, and then we're headed to the other capital of the most important state in Eurasia, and I don't mean Russia, I mean India. But first, Beijing. Professor, the leader of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping, much in the news for his diplomatic initiatives at the behest of his foreign ministry, I'm sure, the peace in the Middle East and conversation in Moscow with Vladimir Putin, a no-limit a partnership. And there's even talk of a phone call or some exchange with Zelensky in Kyiv, although nothing's come of that. So Beijing's point of view, I mention also that the information I had during the week that I account is that the recovery from the zero-COVID disaster is not going well and that Beijing remains troubled by its trade numbers and its unemployment. Troubled is a diplomatic word. So Beijing's point of view.
Well, I think what you say, troubled, is absolutely right. At one of our American universities, we've just had a conference that ended today about the future of China, and one of the participants called me up to put me into the picture, as we used to say. And I couldn't believe what complete nonsense these people were saying. What we have to understand about China is that China is, first of all, she's been overestimated ever since the late 1960s and the 1970s. And the whole Kissinger-Nixon initiative, and then it got even worse with Carter, and then Clinton added a few more twists that made it just terrible. That was based on illusions that according to the Dutch Research Institute in Groningen that looks at what's really the case. And they said that that probably you have to discount the claimed Chinese GNP by about 60%. It's quite clear that the country is really, they're on the edge of bankruptcy. And they owe a tremendous amount of money, which they simply don't have. I think it was yesterday, or perhaps it was the day before, the Federal Reserve Bank quietly lent $60 billion to the Hong Kong Monetary Authority because the Hong Kong dollar is pegged to the U.S. dollar. And what's interesting is that if Hong Kong ceases to have a convertible currency, then she's finished economically. Of course, I think she already is because of other reasons. But the interesting thing is that Peking was not able to come up with the U.S. dollars needed to do this backing, and the Fed had to bail out Hong Kong to keep going the pretense that somehow Hong Kong is dynamic. But in any case, the Japanese have also had a meeting, and they're very good. And they say, and I think this makes some sense, that Xi has now installed himself in power. And it's rather unlikely, given how pervasively and thoroughly he has replaced everybody in the whole bureaucracy, and he's changed everything. He's even taken Mao off of the list of sacred books, and to be replaced with exclusively by Mr. Xi's works. And therefore, it's unlikely that he is going to be somehow ejected from power. He has an extraordinary degree of control, but he doesn't have popularity at all. I think that he is despised by most Chinese, and that means that he is in a political dilemma. There is a saying in Chinese to have disasters at home and sort of defeats abroad, and what he is doing is giving up, to some extent, the wolf warrior diplomacy. They're now trying to make friends with the United States and the Philippines. So they don't understand that the only way that anybody is going to be convinced is if they alter their behavior, that their word is not worth anything. And he's going to be focusing on strengthening his power in China. He's extending the police system. He's essentially building a new bottom story for the Chinese police system, so that in every city neighborhood, in every village, there's going to be a police station. He's counting on simple repression and brainwashing to keep everything going. But this doesn't explain how people are going to be employed. The economy is shrinking, and demand is falling, and there's no obvious way that he's like Russia. It's not clear what Putin could do to save things now. And likewise, I think Xi may be a leader that who presides over gradual and perhaps catastrophic decay. So China is probably not going to be the kind of geopolitical player. I think that Xi understands that if he were to attack Taiwan, Taiwan is now an international issue. This is what the Chinese have long feared. And just Japan would be able to prevent China from taking Taiwan. If you've got the number of countries that are now on board, and we've got the United States getting serious about this, having tried to get Taiwan to disappear, now we're realizing that there's a real danger of war there. But it would be the end for Mr. Xi, and I think he would rather be like Chiang Kai-shek, who was sat in Taiwan and said, you can recover the mainland. But he never, if you had gone to the GMO and said, look, I figured it out, how about a year from now on February 11th, we recover the mainland. And I think the GMO would say, well, that's a good idea, but I think we probably want to do a little bit more research. I believe it's very important for us to be strong militarily. It's very strong for important for our allies to be militarily strong. We have to own the technologies. We can't cut on any of this. But as long as we maintain our strength and Japan and the others come up and become strong too, then I think that Xi is going to prefer to keep moving the date for the liberation of Taiwan out into the future and enjoy life such as it is in the Imperial City.
Professor H.J. McIntyre, International Relations, commenting on Six Capitals, Six Points of View. We're headed to Delhi. The power of Asia emerging. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague, Professor H.J. McIntyre, International Relations. Again, to the Financial Times, the article about Russia's new foreign policy. It reads, while Russia's new foreign policy strategy acknowledges the U.S.'s role as a, quote, influential development center, it portrays Washington as, quote, the organizer and executor of anti-Russian policy of the collective West. It marks a sharp contrast to the last doctrine, which expressed a desire to build working relations with the U.S. Now this paragraph. According to the concept, China and India are seen as friendly, sovereign global centers of power that share Russia's view of the future world order. In quotes, Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt are also seen as key allies. Professor, I was gobsmacked when I read this. A very strange list, but it's the Russian list. So let's focus on India. Russia sees India as a friendly, sovereign global center of power. What is India's point of view about this unusual appeal from Moscow?
Well, I think that in New Delhi, they've been through a lot. Remember that they had the Nehru dynasty in control, certainly within living memory, and they have, while nobody was looking, they have developed very productive agriculture. They export food. China imports food constantly. They have a lot of very educated people. They have terrible poverty in places, but so do we. And so certainly does China and Russia. But I think that there are two things that I think. First, I think it's a mistake to think that India sees things the way the Russians do. I think that the current administration in India regrets very much the degree of reliance on Russia that the Nehru dynasty established. And if you look at, say, where, but yet they also understand, I think they have a great deal of confidence and pride in their system, which is pretty darn good for a country with the kind of enormous population and lack of natural endowments and so forth that India faces. But I don't think I think they view themselves very much as being a politically advanced, a democratic country. And people point out that it isn't quite that, but look at how there are think tanks in sort of Scandinavia that rate who has the best democracy. And the United States, we're usually somewhere, you know, between, we're in the 20s or in the 10s. Certainly what I see of our politics, I don't find it very attractive, although I think we're indispensable and we have a lot of potential, and at our best, we can do well. But there are two things about India that I should mention that I think are going to help her a lot. First, India is a politically stable state. You may remember that Black Day, October 31st, 1984, way back, I guess, before most Americans living today had been born. But the then ruler of India was Indira Gandhi, who was, of course, Pandit Nehru's daughter. And she was cracking down on the Sikhs in Amritsar and Punjab, and she had her army kind of shooting at the Sikhs around the Golden Temple, which is their holy of holies. And I had a student at that time who was the officer of the day on that day, October 31st, 1980. He was the officer of the day at the prime minister's office. And I don't remember what time it was in the day, but the bodyguard of Mrs. Gandhi, who was a Sikh, and he wasn't very happy with what she was doing to his sacred city or to his people, just took his AK-47 or whatever, and he emptied it into Mrs. Gandhi. And that was the end of her, and as it turned out, of really the Nehru dynasty. But what my student impressed on me, and what I was also impressed by, was that in India, all he did as officer of the day was call up somebody and say, look, the prime minister has been shot dead. You know, we've got to move everybody around according to what the Constitution says. So they lost Mrs. Gandhi, but there was no internal war in India. There was no political crisis. And in fact, the Sikhs who are... they're settled in a way. They have settled. They felt secure enough that they have settled mixed with all the populations in India, whereas some groups like the Muslims and the Hindus keep themselves in different parts of cities, but the Sikhs are all over the place. So they really have a lot to fear if there should be a pogrom or something, because they can't just sort of close the gates to the ghetto or call out all the guys and block the streets, because they're just mixed in with everybody. But in fact, nothing at all happened. The other point that must be stressed is that India is a nuclear power, and they have done the best job of anybody since the United States, and we had six European-born physicists, five of whom were Jewish, and one of whom, Fermi, was married to a Jewish woman who Hitler sent over here to help us with our bomb program. And then we had Oppenheimer, whose father had come. And we invented the bomb, and then Stalin got it from us before Truman even knew it existed. But I was in India in May 1998, what was called Pokhran 2, when the Indians detonated their H-bomb. And I met a number of people, including the then president of India, who was a famous physicist, and I met the man who did the H-bomb. And I also had some very good talks with the defense minister, George Fernandez, who is one of the most impressive people I've ever met. He deceased in 2019, but he's just most remarkable man, and he was always opposed to the Nehru dynasty. So now we have a completely different political orientation in India. But for geopolitical reasons, they have to keep Russia and China apart. Because if Russia and China get together, then India is going to be the one that's going to be squeezed. Right now, no one knows how to deal with India. What's the fact that India is a nuclear power, is growing economically, and so forth, is just a source of complete astonishment to the Chinese, who always underestimated the Indians, even though, of course, the Buddhism was brought from India to China, and the various sutras that are in Chinese, they're all translated from Sanskrit. And the United States also was not too quick on the uptake about where India could go, but I suspect that India is going to be because she is a democracy, and because if you want to make a career in politics there, you have to get elected to the legislature. And that means you have to spend time, God forbid, in the countryside telling all of these wretched peasants, you know, by gaslight, that they should vote for you rather than the next guy who's going to come and see them the next night. And if they don't vote for you, then you can't go and be in the parliament. That means that they are very much focused on domestic politics. And they're not going to try to project domestic problems into the international arena as a way of taking the pressure off internally. Whereas in China, as in Russia, internal political problems are really the source of external aggression and slightly or very, very irrational behavior. So I think that India is going to turn out to be what everybody thought that China was going to be, namely, in the words of, what's his name? Anyway, a responsible stakeholder. This poor guy, he's very well known. He's a very smart guy. But he will be known forever as the person who said China was going to be a responsible stakeholder, which is the exact opposite of what China's turned out to be. I think India is much more likely to be a huge, highly productive, militarily very powerful country that is also sort of normal and where speech is free and decisions are made perhaps in a kind of a cumbersome way. But I think the Indian strategists have got a better sense of what's coming in the world, I think, than the people in our country who write about strategy. I have a lot of respect for them. And as I said, I knew Fernandez fairly well. I mean, he's as smart as they come.
Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, generously commenting on six capitals, six points of view, and Moscow believing that India is a friendly power puzzle. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.